And now we'll have our sermon by Reverend Gregory Wilson entitled Original Sin and Universal Neurosis.
It's original sin or universal neurosis. Not both. Well, I'm asked to give sermon titles sometimes a month in advance or 2 weeks in advance. And I'll tell you, it's not an easy chore, because by the time you give the sermon titles, usually I'm already contemplating material about the sermon titles, and certainly that's what gives me the ideas. But in the meantime, you can do a lot of reading and studying and contemplating, and so sometimes that shifts or not. And then sometimes I'll get comments on the titles, such as, who is going to show up at a Unitarian Universalist church if you're preaching on original sin? I thought that was a reasonable thing, but I thought it might provoke enough curiosity that people would show up. Upon further contemplation, I began to realize that, looking at the history of original sin and some of the thoughts and history about the concept of universal neurosis, I began to realize that these two topics are windows into the deep spirituality and into the deep life, or to the deep hindrances of spirituality and human potential and us potentializing ourselves as human in Western civilization, into the very fabric of our culture. And I know that in any spiritual transformation and in our community here and in our sermons and in our classes that we have and groups that we have and the ministry of music that we have, spiritual transformation is part of what we do. And I think it's even if it doesn't sound like it at times, it is underneath in a value that we try to work with in our community. And I also know that in spiritual transformation, one way to try to understand or look at spiritual transformation is in the idea of two cones hooked together. And when you bring your worldview and you bring your ideas and your beliefs and your history, your personal history, or the histories that you've chosen for yourself from your culture, from the history of the Republican, history of the Democrat Club, history of progressives, history of Christianity, history of Buddha, whatever history you graft yourself into. Because throughout life, we will graft ourselves in our personal history. We will graft ourselves into some historical track. We will. And part of our obligation, I think, as humans, is to identify which historical track I have grafted myself in, and do I agree with that or do I not agree with that? And can I be more circumspect or more aware of what I'm doing? And I think as we look at our culture, we do see some odd things. We see people professing a theology of love but behaving like they hate. And so we do see a mixture of beliefs and storylines and people saying they have certain beliefs and they are a certain way, but yet they belong to a larger group that's not necessarily congruent with their values. And so we need to look at those things. So we bring all of that, and we bring that to a point in spiritual transformation. And we begin to ask the questions of meaning, who are we, what are we, what's our purpose, and how are we to be involved in community. And when we do that, when we bring ourselves to that point of spiritual transformation, we let things go. And we begin anew. And it's like we are at a point. Some people call it an epiphany. Some people say, I was brought into the light and now I'm leaving the light. And there are many places, many ways to describe that. However, when we do that, and we do come to that point of spiritual transformation, we begin the process all over again, and we begin to broaden out. We begin to adopt new beliefs, new cultural beliefs, new beliefs about the self. Some would say that at the point of that cone, if you're in a group, in a room full of mystics who are meditating and praying, that they are all at the same point in spiritual transformation. And it's when the first one speaks that they begin to disagree and that and their worldviews begins to widen. So spiritual transformation in relationship to original sin and universal neurosis is beginning to make sense to me. And I'm hoping that I can help it make sense if it doesn't. I got something jingling in my pocket that's aggravating me. So get that out. We also, as human beings, we live by story. We live by myth. We live by how we understand the world and interpret the world. And you can see this in certainly religious traditions, that each religious tradition will have its story. One thing I've noticed in Unitarian Universalism is that sometimes we become a house of people who have abandoned stories, who have rendered stories meaningless, who have said, I don't want to be a part of that story. And in a way, sometimes some of us we have lost any moorings because we realize that myths aren't truth. That stories don't convey absolute truths. And because of that, and we seek out truth, we kind of dismiss the story, especially if the story reveals something that I don't like. We want to let that go and not be part of it. But at the same time, I think we hurt ourselves when we do that, because that is how we make meaning, we humans. We make meaning out of story. And so I thought, well, if we're going to understand the story of Unitarian Universalists and understand the story of spiritual transformation and getting along better as a community, how do I fit original sin and universal neurosis into a story and into a myth so that it makes sense? So I'm going to try to put that into story form. And I'm going to begin with the thought of a philosopher named Plotinus. And I shared this recently, and some of these things that you may say, well, we have talked about these before, and I have shared these ideas before, and it's true. And I have, but I never really shared them in maybe a story form or a congruent step form. It's like when we've gone over the story of the Buddha. And when Siddhartha left the kingdom, where he was to be the future king, and said, even as king, I will not be able to help my subjects out of poverty. And when he realized that, he left his kingdom. And the first thing he did when he got to the woods and he found a master, the master told him, you have to learn to concentrate. You have to learn to breathe. And so Siddhartha went off into the woods and spent 15 days or so practicing breathing. I used to have an uncle, and I would call him up and I would say, well, Michael, what are you doing? And he'd say, I'm practicing my breathing. You know, and at first I thought he was odd. What do you mean you're practicing your breathing, right? What do you mean by that? Then I read the Siddhartha story and I said, oh, he's practicing his breathing. Then the Buddha comes back after learning that. He comes back to the master and he says, well, I've got that done. Now what do I do? And the master says, you must let go of the future and the past. You must let go of the future and past. So you've got to practice your breathing. You've got to learn to concentrate. You can't deal with letting go of your future and past unless you've learned to breathe. Is what he was taught. So that was step two. So he goes away for a month and meditates and practices on letting go of the future and past. Now, how I know that Siddhartha was pretty special is that
I've been working 25 years of letting go of my past and future. I don't know about how some of you have gone through support groups, have gone through counseling, have stopped having conversations with mother and father in your head, or have stopped having conversations about historical events you wish that would have gone differently in your history. I mean, how many of us still struggle with that? I struggle with that. But yet, that is what he had to practice, and he comes back and he said, I'm done. I have let go of the future and past. So then the master says, now you must let go of all attachment to material things, and you must recognize that all things are really an illusion. How do you do that? How do you practice your breathing? How do you let go of the future and past? How do you recognize that all things are an illusion, and the things that we have in our mind are belief systems, and how we interpret things and how we absolutely know things that are true are really an illusion? Because that's what the master asked the Buddha to do. I can remember a time I was walking on a hill with my father, and my father's a union man, fought for Democratic Party his whole life. And this was right after the election of Bush and Clinton had won. And so we're walking along, and my father said, you know, I don't know why Bush did not speak and address and proclaim all the good things he had done. And I went, what? What? Because in my mind, Democrat good, Republican bad, right? And thinking I'm idealizing my father, and that's where that's coming from. And so here comes this belief that I've got, that I believe I'm taking from him. And here comes this objectivity saying, well, he actually did a lot of good things. Did some environmental stuff, did some things here, did some things here. But he never really talked about them in the election. You know, I was driven by an illusion, by a belief that was handed to me, that I believed was handed to me from somebody else, and I stayed within a community that reinforced that belief, that reinforced that illusion, and it really was not true. So, in order to break the illusions, I have to recognize that I'm very vulnerable to build a community that will reinforce my illusions. And I have to have some sense, some in my community, some practice, as we had in our reading, some practice to be able to break through the illusions. I have to have some sense and some recognition that I function under an illusion. And I have illusions in my brain that I don't think that are illusions, but they're there. But as time goes by, I need to be in a process that it's okay for me to let go of illusions, to let go of beliefs. Recently, I turned 55. And I know that I had beliefs at 20, 25, 30, 35, and 40 that were illusions. I mean, how many of you have had beliefs historically that you've outgrown or that you let go of? Well, what would make me think that at 55, I'm any different than when I was 25? Because at 65, I'm going to recognize that when I was 55, I still had illusions. And that it's okay. And that I need to let go of those illusions. So back to Plotinus. He gave us a model and an understanding of our minds that came in three parts. And he said that there is this part, that there is this divine sense of who we are as human beings. And when we move into that divine sense, and he's not necessarily talking an external God, he's just talking about within us, within our minds, that when he meditates and that when he sits still, that when he went inside himself, he found a place and discovered a place within him that was pure light and burned away everything that had happened to him in his life, and so that there was a purity to it, there wasn't any thought to it. It was just by himself in this light. In fact, he even lost his sense of self when he went into this light. He disappeared into this light. Now, my mind immediately goes to Poltergeist. You know, I just can't do that and laugh about myself when I do that because I think this is serious. So if you did that, I'm helping you let go of it so you don't have to think about the poltergeist. Go into the light. But in essence, that's what he's saying. Then he says we have this perfect nature. In this perfect nature, there are forms. That's what Plato said, where there is the chair, the perfect chair, the perfect tree. That's how we know that there is a chair, because ultimately in our imaginative process that's universal, there is an image of a chair, of a tree, of a chariot, of a car, that we can all recognize what is. But Plotinus said there's a place beyond that, that there are no forms. But then there is this place called the perfect form. And mystics and philosophers throughout the years have called this the place of angels. You might hear the language of this is the angel of philosophy. This is where Lord Jesus is. This is where Lord Buddha is. This is where the historical religious figures, this is where they live. And in this place, there is a perfection. So we have this divine sense, and then we have this other place that's a perfection place. We'll get to the meaning and how that's helpful or not helpful in just a minute. And then he says, there is the soul. And the soul is a curious place, because the soul, an aspect of the soul, is in touch with the perfect nature. Another aspect of the soul is in touch with the external world. And he suggests that when things are going really well, that when we humans are at our best, we have fluid energy and fluid movement through those three places and what it means to be human, and that we move. And he suggests, and when you read Buddha and the teachings of Jesus, that this sense of delight is an experience of love and compassion, and that love and compassion moves through that perfect nature, moves through that place of the soul, and is externalized into the external world. That's a story. That's a myth. Is it true? I don't know if it's true, but I think it's truthful. I think that when I have an experience of meditation and I use that way of understanding, that when I sit still long enough to let go of the world and to experience some sense of what this light might be, that when that happens and I can let go of my illusions and I can let go of my beliefs and I can let go of my sense of self, that there is some relief in that experience. The problem happens with that particular way of understanding. Let's say there's some truth to that, or that is a way among other ways. That my soul can split. My soul can split. There is a part of me that can get so wrapped up into this external world that I will split my soul and be so outer directed, I have no thought or concept of what it means to go and to travel in my own internal world. And as I shared before, Christopher Bolas, a psychological writer, he has a name for that and says we are now in an academic of that, and he calls that the normotic personality. Excessively normal. We're excessively normal because we perpetually conform to the external world for our sense of belonging and our sense of well-being. And that's what we do. When that happens, we lose touch with that part of our soul that's in touch with that sense of ourselves, that perfect nature sense. And at that point, there are signs when we're there. When we impose our belief on somebody else, when we feel ourselves attracted to a religion that has absolute belief systems in it, we are there. When we look for an external authority, we are there. When we sacrifice ourselves and live as victims, we are there. We are there. And we are usually there because we are wounded. We are a wounded people. Recently, well, not within the last 10 years, there have been many of us that have asked the question, where is the outrage of the people? Maybe we're seeing it recently in Chicago when the bankers met. I don't know. When we don't see outrage where there is intrusiveness, when we don't see outrage when a group of people violate their commitment to one another, whether it's a government, a community,
a church, to parishioners, whatever it may be, when we don't see outrage when there's abuse, the soul is injured and damaged. Outrage to abuse is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's a protest of what's going on. It can absolutely be a sign of health. When we enter this divine place, say, and we really feel that sense of love, and we really feel that sense of compassion, and when we're there, we get a sense of relief, and we like to visit there, and we like to visit places that help us get there. When we get there, it's a wonderful experience. If this happens, it's problematic. Sometimes we have that experience, that relief, that divine sense, that pure love sense, that compassion. Sometimes we have that. And we move quickly through that aspect of the perfect nature into the soul, into the external world, and it's almost like a beeline express, and there's no stopping in the perfect nature of who we are, the reformation where the transformation takes place. There's no stopping in the intersection of that perfect nature and where the soul is to modify who we are as we engage the world. It's just a beeline. Now, for Unitarian Universalists, that's problematic, because what that means is I run from what it means to have a sense of relief and the love and compassion and the pure light, and I run right into conformity into the external world, and I bounce back between the two. Why that's difficult for Unitarian Universalists, there's no social justice in that process. There's conformity to the world, or there's a pure sense of light. And how many of you have ever had friends or have known people that, you know, that we say we're spiritual and all that, but yet you think there's a protest, or yet you want to talk about social justice issues, and you know they're good people, and they say, well, I don't get into that. Well, I don't talk about that. Well, I'm not going to be about that. Well, that's not really spiritual, that's political. You know, that's not who I am. When we have that experience with the divine, we step into that place as we begin to return to the world. We step back into that place of the perfect nature so that we begin to put a shape and we can begin to put form to our experience from the divine. That's what that place, that's what that part of humanity is about. It's that we have this experience that we have let go of the illusions, as is taught in the Buddha story, that we can let go of the illusions, and when we have that place of letting go of the illusions, if we're not careful, we're liable to spring right back into the same old behavior. How many of us have ever tried to stop something and we've had a wonderful experience, and we say, this is a wonderful thing that has happened to us, I've had this experience and I'm going to change, and 6 months later we find ourselves doing the same behavior? That's what we're talking about here. When we have that experience, when we've let go, and there is that sense of purity, and we're past our thinking, and we're just in that kind of a place of energy, we stop at the place where there's the perfect forms, where there's the nature, and we take a deep breath, and we allow that energy to take the form in which our ideal self would like and would like to be. And we dwell there for a while, so that when we step into that place of the soul, we even strengthen it there, so that when we begin to engage the world, we can hold together. I can remember a time, boy, this will be a confession. I can remember a time when I was really young, 17, so it doesn't count. And I said I was going to quit a particular behavior. That particular behavior was form of an Indian meditation process. Wasn't tired. And I said, I'm going to cook this. So I'd still hang out with the same friends, and you know, and I had a solid sense, I'm going to quit this. And I was in a fundamentalist church, and when I went out with my wrestling and football buddies, it was very dualistic. And I would get with my buddies and we'd go out. Of course, they had all continued their religious practice in the car while I was still in the car, so it was really hard to quit. But that solid sense of self that I had, I would watch it fragment.
And I'd experienced the despair of it fragmenting because I wasn't strong enough to hold it together. And I think in the culture that we're in, our spiritual journeys that we're in, that periodically we do have these epiphanies of things we want to change, and we do have these epiphanies that I don't want to be like that anymore. I want to let that behavior go. I want to let that negative self-belief go. I want it to drift away. And I get into a place where I have a positive experience and I feel really strong about it, and my ego is holding together about it, and I'm in a powerful spot. But over time, I move through time and it fragments, and I find myself back in the place where I was, and I despair over it. And I lose any self-confidence that I'm going to be able to make the changes I want. I lose any self-confidence that I have. I'm going to be able to become who I want to be in this world, and I'm going to have to settle for something lesser. When that happens, it's because we move from that place of power too quickly through those aspects of ourselves that are designed to give us strength so that when we engage the world, we can hold ourselves together. In these next several weeks in dealing with these matters of original sin and universal neurosis, these are the windows into identifying the ways in which when I begin to hold myself together and make those changes I want to make, these two areas are windows that will help me identify how it is I don't maintain the self that I want to maintain. How it is I fall prey to the very things I want to let go of. How it is that the ideas about original sin are embedded in our culture and have taken on a different language that aren't religious. It's not even a religious language at all, but the essence, the process of the belief system of original sin is still in our culture. It's not in our churches. It's still there. A closed loop which we perpetually put ourselves down. A closed loop in which I can never become who I want to be. A closed loop that's always judging me in a negative way. That's the process of original sin, that there's something wrong with me that can never change. Just because of who I am, there is something wrong with me. Any process that where I end up in a movement and I come back to there's still something wrong with me has a relationship to that theology of original sin. The difference with universal neurosis, and we'll tend to that in more detail, is that that is not a closed system. That is more of an open system. Because we can make what is unconscious conscious and then deal with it. We are always not locked in to the neuroses that we struggle with. And the definition of neuroses I find helpful or sometimes not helpful is that I struggle with these tendencies that are problematic, but yet I function just fine in society. So there's no real pressure on me to change because I'm doing okay. But I'm still reactive. I'm still addictive. I'm still self-deprecating. I'm still putting other people down. I'm still not available for intimacy the way I'd like to be available for intimacy. I still have difficulty receiving care from others. I still have difficulty in caring for others. All the neurotic stuff we all struggle with. That can change. That can be different. And in the next couple of weeks, we're going to open those windows. And we're going to look into those nuances of how we stay in prison, so that we can begin that process of transformation, so that we can come to those points in a transformative process and let those things we need to let go of, we can let them go and we can move in the direction of becoming who we want to be in this world and how we want to be available to ourselves and available to others.